you. There were several people who were texting that they couldn't get in when I was sitting. I hope you got in. And I want to change, Nick, the order of readers. I'll say what it is in a minute. Tonight, I want to offer a few more comments and wonderings about the Gaudiya Sutra, and also touch on the subject of spiritual friends and benefactors, face-to-face concentration, the experience of seeing the world with whole eyes, and a few words on paradox. We'll be looking at benefactors 36 through 41. With the help of four of our Sangha members, Heidi von Gundon, Jeff Harrison, Philip Olson, and Laura Trippi. And I will do the first reading, and then I'm going to switch it so that Laura does the second, and then Philip, then Jeff, then Heidi. That's an order chronology in our sutra. We're going to skip 37, 36, 38, 39, 40, and 41. Each of them will read a selection that they've made and say a few words about why they chose that benefactor. And then after the talk, we'll have breakout groups and a large group discussion. And if you have a pen and paper and you hear something that sparks your interest, that you might bring to a breakout group, please jot it down. You might particularly be listening for, what am I seeing? What am I hearing? What am I seeing? What am I hearing? Entering into communion with everything and everyone. These were Norman's last words last week, as he told us he'd be attending Yom Kippur services tonight. It's a practice he repeats, and many, many millions of Jews repeat every year, praying and engaging in atonement for transgressions from the year past. Looking at vows, forgetting vows, taking back vows. Repetition. And repetition is something I will touch on tonight. He went on to say, so one of the things I brought up tonight was the idea of serving spiritual benefactors. And that I think what the sutra is really telling us is that the only way that we practice is together with everything. That it's not about our accomplishment or the things we're going to do and how we're going to do them. It's really about entering into communion with everything and everyone. So let's enter tonight with the Night Goddess, number 36. And I tried to practice this name. Let's see if I can do it. Sarvana Gararak Shazam Bhavate Jashri. I'm reading from page 1339. Sudana, enraptured upon seeing the night goddess, paid his respects to her and said, O goddess, I've set out for supreme perfect enlightenment. Please tell me how an enlightening being is to be a benefactor to others while carrying out enlightenment practice, and how an enlightening being is to take care of sentient beings with the highest protection and care. And how an enlightening being engaged in the work of enlightening beings by the ascent of the enlightened is to approach the seat of a spiritual sovereign. The night goddess replied, "It's very good that you ask about the way of practicing of distributing teachings to sentient beings according to their mentalities, to attain the goal of guiding all sentient beings to perfection, to attain the goal of the effort to preserve the family of all Buddhas, to apply all pervasive knowledge to confront entry into the ocean of means leading to all realms of reality, to penetrate all knowables by knowledge boundless as space, to receive and hold the teachings of all Buddhas. I have attained an enlightening liberation, entry into the profound miracle of pleasing sound. Having attained this liberation, engaged in preaching the great teaching, free from attachment, dedicated to dissemination of the treasury of teachings of all Buddhas, imbued with the power of great compassion and goodwill, set on working for the welfare of all sentient beings, to inspire them to seek enlightenment, and set out to become a leader of all sentient beings, to ceaselessly accumulate stories of virtues in determination for enlightenment. Engaged in producing clouds of teaching and suns of teaching in all worlds, to guide all sentient beings on the path of omniscience. Ceaselessly reaching out impartially to all sentient beings to illumine all worlds, so as to produce infinite roots of goodness, applying a purified mind to practical knowledge of sustaining the performance of good works of all sentient beings, set out to lead all sentient beings to accord with all paths of good action, engaged in the work of directing all sentient beings in good ways, engaged in showing all sentient beings the way to peace and security, set out to lead all sentient beings to emancipation, engaged in directing all sentient beings to all good practices, set out to serve all spiritual friends, uninterruptedly engaged in directing all sentient beings to the teaching of the enlightened, engaged in undertaking all pure and good practices such as giving, firmly resolved to realize omniscience, with a broad mental sphere firmly focused on the power of Buddhas. I stay by the spiritual benefactor, determined to shatter the mountains of afflictions and obstructions to enlightenment caused by actions, undertaking the preparations for omniscience, engaged in developing all good qualities, engaged in application of thought to the infinite variety of objects confronting omniscience." Page 1341. "Moreover, I teach sentient beings with wisdom consisting of learning, wisdom consisting of thinking, and wisdom consisting of practice. I teach sentient beings about the process of one existence, and I teach sentient beings about the processes of all existences. I teach about the ocean of the names of one Buddha. I teach about the oceans of names of all Buddhas. I teach about one ocean of worlds. I teach about all oceans of worlds. I teach about the ocean of predictions of enlightenment of one Buddha. I teach about the oceans of predictions of enlightenment of all Buddhas. I teach about the ocean of audiences of one Buddha. I teach about the oceans of audiences of all Buddhas. I teach about the cycle of teachings of one Buddha. I teach about the oceans of cycles and teachings of all Buddhas. I teach about one scripture. I teach about the scripture containing the cycles of teachings of all Buddhas. I teach about one gathering of an audience of a Buddha. I teach about the oceans of audiences of all Buddhas. I teach about one thought of omniscience. I teach about the oceans of all elements of determination for enlightenment. I teach about one vehicle of emancipation. I teach about the oceans of all vehicles of emancipation. I teach sentient beings in untold ways such as these." So thank you, Nick. You can take that down. So I pulled out the line ceaselessly accumulating stories of virtues and determination for enlightenment. I stay by the spiritual benefactors. Moreover, I teach sentient beings with wisdom consisting of learning, wisdom consisting of thinking, and wisdom consisting of practice. We're very fortunate to be the beneficiaries of two contemporary spiritual benefactors. Benefactors who teach us about wisdom consisting of learning, wisdom consisting of thinking, wisdom consisting of practice. We are the beneficiaries of their lives. Two men, one still living, one not, who've given their lives to translation, ceaselessly paying attention to and accumulating stories of virtue, staying and supporting the universal goodness of teachings and learnings. And they've created a profound library of translated ancient Buddhist texts for us. I know that we mentioned Thomas Cleary in the early days of studying this sutra, but I wanted to say more about him. And I also wanted to say something about Kaz Ta-Nehisi. So again, both of them have made it possible for us as students and teachers to learn and practice with one another, entering into communion with everything and everyone. Thomas Cleary, who passed away in 2021, brought into the world 90 works through Chinese, Japanese, Sanskrit, Pali, Bengali, Arabic, and also Irish spiritual texts. His books sold millions of copies, and they ranged far beyond Buddhism. He translated works by Taoists, by Greek philosophers, Celtic kings, and the Prophet Muhammad, including the Quran. He was an amazing guy. And Kaz Ta-Nehisi, now still teaching and creating at 93 years old, is a master calligrapher, a pioneer of the genre of one-stroke painting, as well as the creator of multicolor Enso Zen circles, author of over 40 books, including Painting Peace, Heart of the Brush, the Heart Sutra, and translator of Dogen Shobo Genzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, on which he worked 33 years. He paid homage to the Zen Center of San Francisco for supporting him for 33 years. When I heard a talk he gave this past July at Upaya Zen Center in the Dogen Seminar there, which I'll talk about a little bit more. 33 years. Back to Cleary for a minute. Cleary described himself as a spy who was sneaking ideas across the borders of the mind. He was described by others as notoriously private, endlessly curious, modest, brilliant, a genius polymath, a translator of awesome depth. He had no mention of a specific spiritual path or practice in any of the statements he made. And he never claimed a formal teacher with whom he studied. And yet, he is revered as almost single-handedly building the Buddhist canon in English and has been called the greatest translator of Buddhist texts in a generation, maybe more. According to his brother, with whom he lived in Oakland, Thomas had a few moments in his life where he caught glimpses of the oneness of things. But Cleary himself once humbly told an interviewer, "Oh, I had some non-ordinary experiences in childhood And Buddhism helped me put them into perspective. He was skeptical of institutions, and he walked away from a big teaching job on the East Coast. He moved to California and began what he called his spy craft in earnest, focusing on texts not yet available in English and providing short but informative introductions to the worlds in which the works were created. But his friends said he wasn't a recluse. He was deeply engaged with the world, preferring to teach through his books and during one-on-one seminars with a select group of students, a man known to be most comfortable with children and living beings like cats and dogs and nature, wild things. He explained his main motivation in translation in the introduction to one of his books, the book entitled Instant Zen. And by the way, if you haven't read the introduction to this Gandharva Sutra, it's also quite wonderful. Cleary says, "I go directly to the scriptures themselves as the practical relevance of ancient wisdom to modern problems becomes increasingly apparent. There is an ever greater need to retrieve these essential insights from ages of cultural overlay, embellishment, and cultural decline." So, just to repeat, he says, as the practical relevance of ancient wisdom to modern problems becomes increasingly apparent, there's an even greater need to retrieve those teachings, to study them, to immerse ourselves in them. In that introduction, Cleary points out that enlightening beings, just like him, the spy, cut across all kinds of conventional views and presumed boundaries. They're not organized, this is a quote from him, they're not organized in a perceptible formal hierarchy or institution. They're not always known to the public for what they are. They are known to each other according to their own attainments, their own realizations. And it's through the successive direction of the guides themselves that Sudhana is then exposed to the whole truth. So the sutra opens us to narratives of these enlightening beings, to benefactors and spiritual friends, young and old, female and male, Buddhist and non-Buddhist, renunciates and householders, members of various classes, experts in various professions, arts, sciences. He says, they respond, and yet no one tries to bind Sudhana to him, to a given system of dogma, or to keep him as a follower. Many of them teach in surroundings and formats. They're not overly associated with what is we would think conventionally as religion. And then he adds these important lines. The task of enlightening beings is to purposely bridge boundaries of culture and religion, bridging boundaries of the secular and the sacred, to relieve mundane sufferings and anxieties that would otherwise preoccupy our mental energy and hinder further awakenings. So, enlightening beings are everywhere, all the time, bridging boundaries that may not be visible to us. Or they themselves may appear in contradictory suits of clothing, in disguise. But as Norman told us in one of his talks, there's always another Buddha just around the next corner. We may need to see more deeply to really see what's going on. Our second great spiritual benefactor, Kaz, is 93 years old, a master calligrapher, as I said before, a pioneer in painting, one stroke painting as well as this multicolor Enso Zen circle style that we all love. He's not only this brilliant translator, we're going to call him a seer for tonight, one who sees clearly and deeply, wholeheartedly. He's a beloved friend to many, many people in this community and throughout the Zen world, including Norman and Kathy, who taught with him in that July seminar last summer. The seminar was called Meeting Paradox in the Teachings of Zen Master Dogen. Cause it offered teachings from an article he recently published on paradox and Dogen's teachings. He had collected 300 paradoxes in the Shobogenzo. And he called paradox in our practice three things: freedom from self, freedom from division, and freedom from conventional modes of thinking. All good things to remember as we study the Gaudiya Sutra. He laughed and said, "Paradox is a language of nonsense. So listen nonsensically, just not being non-dual. It's a device to awaken people to experiencing prajnaparamita," he said, "the realization of wisdom beyond wisdom, paradox." And then, under the three different ways he had of talking about this word, this concept, this force, and I guess energy in our practice, freedom from the self, freedom from division, and freedom from conventional views. He listed different qualities, and the one I think that I used most in this talk was freedom from conventional views, where he has five different ways that that shows up. In upside down language, that's a very Dogen thing. In tautology or negative tautology, going beyond the ultimate. What is imaginary is real, and contradiction to accepted facts. So all of that is often found in Dogen, as I just said, but it's also suggested in many of these stories too. And so what we learn by listening a little bit about one who's a spy and the other who's not afraid to talk nonsense is that translators don't just interpret specific words. They're gifts of knowledge and perception, their consciousness and ways of seeing are intricately and subtly woven into the meaning of texts. So I just wanted to be grateful for the two of them tonight and to say we're blessed to have had them during this time of us being alive. So I'll stop there for a moment and ask if Laura would read from her selection, number 38. Are you there, Laura? I saw her earlier.
There. Sorry, I wasn't able to unmute myself, but here I am. Thank you very much, Jean. That was beautiful. And I especially loved what you said at the end, that Translators don't just interpret, that their consciousness is fully woven into the texts. It's beautiful. So I'm going to be reading from Spiritual Benefactor number 38.
Can you spotlight her, Nick? Or no, I mean just
Or the text,
sorry,
either one.
the text.
So this is the eighth night goddess, and I did not practice her name, but I know that from Thomas Cleary, I know that her name is Light of Energy of the Vow to Protect All Beings. Her teaching is particularly about our Bodhisattva vow, and the passage that I chose is about the importance of spiritual friends. And as I understand it, it's not meant as a different category from the spiritual benefactors. They're spiritual friends, but it has a much more intimate quality because Cleary chooses the term friends there, and it spoke to me of Sangha and community. So then Sudana went to the night goddess, light of energy of the vow to protect all beings, and saw her sitting in that same assembly as the previous night goddess on a seat of jewels, reflecting the abodes of all beings. Her body was covered with a net of jewels, reflecting the principles of the cosmos. Sudana, seeing her, bowed his head, remembering as many ways of seeing her as atoms in a Buddha land. He prostrated himself on the ground for a long time. Finally, rising from the ground in a reverential attitude, Sudana gazed at the body of the night goddess, and as he did so, he attained 10 purities of thought, whereby he gained communality with all spiritual friends. What were those 10? He thought of spiritual friends as his own mind, to associate with them in all situations in the effort to attain omniscience. He thought of them as the pure essence of the development of his own actions, to accomplish the attainment of extensive roots of goodness to please spiritual friends. He thought of them as adorning the practice of enlightening beings, to associate with them in carrying out adornment by all spiritual vows. He thought of them as bringing him to all aspects of Buddhahood, to practice the paths taught by all spiritual friends. He thought of them as the state of comfort, to manifest the abode of the supreme state of the realm of all Buddhas. He thought of them as the one way of emancipation, to purify the practice of the commitment of emancipation by the vehicle of universal good. He thought of them as oceans of virtues of omniscience to increase the production of all good qualities. He thought of them as fulfilling, increasing, and preserving all consummate good, to increase the force of energetic effort for total knowledge of complete enlightenment. He thought of them as fulfilling all roots of goodness, to fulfill the aspirations of all beings. He thought of spiritual friends as fulfillers of all aims, to establish the mastery of all acts of enlightening beings. He attained these 10 purities of thought, where he attained these 10 purities of thought, whereby he attained communality with the night goddess and enlightening beings as numerous as atoms in a Buddha land.
Thank you, Laura. So, Sudana had a great expanse of his social set. His spiritual friends expanded meeting that goddess. And that just sometimes the language is so beautiful. Thank you. That was really touching. For me. So I will go on. reading a Mahayana Sutra, writing a Dharma talk, or listening to one can sometimes be like following a detective story, an investigation into different texts and translations, and deciphering different Dharma relationships, piecing together associations, intuitions, memories, clues gleaned from hearing other talks, vapor trails of words from readings and conversations, sounds, sights, smells, gestures, words appearing, assembling on a page, thoughts that can open pathways to reveal a bodhisattva path that might lead to different questions, to different kinds of relationships, to spiritual friendships, sometimes radiant bursts of feeling in our bodies, insights based not on anything linear or analytical, an experience beyond words, something that flows in continuous currents, encouragement, trust, a bodhisattva pilgrimage of studying and forgetting the self. The investigation doesn't ever really resolved with who done it, or even you done it. Perhaps our world is beginning to face we done it. Everything, everyone done it. Or even better, just the word done, or it, or no word at all. Just someone holding up a flower and a smile and a recognition, a transmission. The Dharma is beyond words and letters, said great Zen ancestor Dogen. And yet he also said, kind speech has the power to turn the destiny of a nation. A paradox. So back to communion with everyone and everything. And I'm returning to these words, repeating them, because this is a guidance that's so important. Repetition in our spiritual life of carrying a vow of compassion as individuals and as a sangha. Repetition of ritual, recitation, sitting, studying, repenting, renewing our bodhisattva vows at the full moon ceremonies, chanting for the safe passage and well-being of our loved ones, and also of people we don't know so far away. Repeating the loving kindness metta phrases. Metta, the literal translation of the word, is friendship. Repeating the deep sense that our lives have something to do with each other. Going to Doksan with our teacher, even when we think we have nothing to say. And how we close many of our times together, beautiful times at the end of our times, with that ancient soul sound of the Pali refuges. As I've said, I know many times I have this quote on my altar here from Suzuki Roshi. If you lose the spirit of repetition, your practice will become difficult. Our ancestors, those we carry in our biological DNA, as well as spiritual ancestors from Zen and maybe other traditions, those who have embraced us and we have embraced back, highly valued repetition as a form of sustained attention, returning repeatedly to a practice, to a black cushion or a chair, to a time of day, a place in nature, a favorite nearby street, sharing Dharma with a spiritual friend or benefactor. Repetition engenders depth and familiarity, getting intimate with nature and our own wild natures is a matter of going face to face many times. That was said not by me, but by a famous poet, Gary Snyder. Near the end of last week's talk, Norman spoke of this kind of intimacy in remarks about the goddess of 10,000 concentrations as expressing, quote, what one would call face-to-face communication with all Buddhas, the moment when something crosses over from not being a living being to the first stirrings of awakeness, the arising of life, which is such a strange thing, so subtle, pleasant. That first blush so profoundly moving that it leads to the concentration of face-to-face with the Buddhas. What we mean in our tradition by practicing together, hand-to-hand, face-to-face, body-to-body, mind-to-mind. What new life is stirring? What is preparing to cross over in our life? Moving us toward face to face. What are we really seeing? I'm going to stop there and ask Philip to read.
Thank you, John. It's beautiful. I'm going to read just briefly from the testimony of the teacher whom Sadhana met, I think, right after his meeting with the teacher with the very long name that Laura introduced.
We all have very long names, Philip. Many of them do.
I'm not going to even mention his name, but what struck me about this passage that I'm about to read snatches of is what for me. What a beautiful portrait of our practice emerges from the first five or six of these 10 qualities of of practice, I guess. And Norman mentioned in one of his first talks on this sutra that the number 10 comes up a lot, and it has been easy for me to think, oh, another 10, and miss or just kind of skim over. I'm so glad that I didn't skim over this. I'm just going to read the first five of these 10 practices of enlightening beings, and because to me they describe so beautifully kind of the beginning stages of practice of not just Buddhism, but maybe any religious practice or any practice that one undertakes seriously. And these are transmitted to Sadhana by the goddess. And I'm going to.
It's okay.
Oh, well, I can't find the page that has her name on it, so I'm not going to try to remember it. But anyhow, so she lists 10 qualities, which she calls births, ways in which the enlightening beings give birth to themselves the way we change. The first one, she says, it's called the birth of enlightening beings as offspring. And these are all offsprings of different qualities. The birth of enlightening beings as offspring of the undertaking of the vow to serve all Buddhas. And this seemed to me to be such a beautiful expression of maybe our attitude, of attitude of many of us when we start practicing with a senior teacher like Jean or Norman, and just feel such a warm feeling of gratitude and connection with that person. What she says about this
Nick, can you make it a little bigger?
Oh, thank you. So the first birth of enlightening beings is that an undertaking the vow to serve all Buddhas. She says, here the enlightening beings honoring, respecting, serving, attending, and pleasing all Buddhas, just as when they first made offerings in the service of a Buddha. So the sense of this feeling of devotion and dedication always being something new, something inspiring. The second birth is the birth of enlightening beings as offspring of consummation of all elements of the determination for enlightenment. And again, especially in Zen practice maybe, but probably in any religious practice, there is a sense of wanting to achieve consummation of having a goal which we're not supposed to have, but we do, and which can be inspiring. The third is the birth of enlightening beings as offspring of meditation that as Zen students we're all familiar with and yet it's always something mysterious and new. The fourth aspect of the fourth birth, as she calls it, and tells Sudhana, is the birth of enlightening beings as the offspring. And each of these is seen as an offspring of a practice, something that's given birth by the practice, offspring of purification of the intent of viewing past, present, and future. And this she describes as emphasizing this element of intent as our practice maybe matures. She says they enlightening beings come into the range of enlightenment of Buddhas. There's a maturing going on as they enter the ocean of methods of enlightening beings. Their minds are firm, governed by an intent as strong as steel. Fifth, and I'm almost finished with this part of the 10, seeing the birth of enlightening beings as offspring of the light of universal awareness. And this awareness, relates to the experience of thusness and acting out of the thusness, which often can be an aspiration, but also indicates the very practice itself. And finally, the sixth of these 10 births is maybe I'll just leave it at the sixth. I was just very moved by how not just accurate, but how deeply sensitive this depiction of religious practice was And that kind of sensitivity, it seems to me, underlies so much of the beautiful language of this sutra. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philip. Yeah, thanks. That was really worth it, too. You had quite a time. Thanks so much for putting that effort in. So as I'm looking at Philip, I'm thinking face to face. Back to that for a moment. Norman stressed last week to us the importance of face to face. From his fascicle 57, Dogen says, "I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the wondrous heart of Nirvana." And then in that famous incident of the flower and the smile, he says, "I entrust it to Mahakashyapa. By seeing Mahakashyapa, he intimately entrusted him with the Dharma." And then Shakyamuni said, "This itself is holding up a flower on Vulture Peak. This is a Buddha ancestor transmitting the treasury of the eye face to face. It occurs only in our teaching. Other people have not even dreamed of it." And then Dogen's words, "This is the meaning of transmitting the treasury of the true Dharma eye face to face, from Buddha to Buddha, from ancestor to ancestor, offspring to offspring," as Philip said. He goes on to talk about his own teacher, Rujing. He said, "I first offered incense and bowed formally to my teacher Rujing in the abbot's room, and he also saw me for the first time. Upon this occasion, he transmitted Dharma to me, finger to finger, face to face, and said, 'The Dharma gate of face to face transmission from Buddha to Buddha, ancestor to ancestor, is actualized now.' A face to face transmitting Buddha transmits to a face to face transmitting Buddha. There are no Buddhas without receiving face to face transmission from the Buddha face." So Sudhana left home to go on pilgrimage for this experience of face to face. And what we learn is that spiritual pilgrimage is also one of those repetitions, one of those universal repetitive narratives across many cultures, many traditions. A spiritual seeker seeking intimacy, studying the self to forget the self. Just like Sudhana, this familiar narrative structure and pattern is, and this is a quote, "a foundational template that follows a repetitive pattern of deepening, of understanding and revelation. Each encounter offering a piece of wisdom while pointing the pilgrim to the next guide, creating a journey of gradual transformation rather than sudden enlightenment." Whether we actually go out on the road or we stay at home, we sit on our cushion, we get on the 7:30 in the morning sitting, we come to Dharma seminar, we can all go on this pilgrimage, this transformation, this journey. So in these present days, repetition of another kind of narrative in our present moment, the radical change and suffering in the mundane whirl, is making everything difficult. The violence and the chaos in today's world can be experienced as a repeated assault on the narrative many of us learned about as the stability and nobility of America's Constitution. Something happening we didn't believe could happen. That's one of those paradoxes. An upside downing of our country's democracy and rule of law. So I'm remembering, kind speech has the power to turn the destiny of a nation. I was talking to a friend about the relevancy of studying this sutra at the present moment. He asked if the Gandavyuha had anything to do with helping in the world as it is right now. So I sent him Norman's September 17th talk, in which he told us his thoughts about this experience right now, with a special emphasis on seeing. He said, I've been saying every week, the sutra is not really a different world, it's the same world. And we have to develop the eyes to see that it's part of the same world and not be inundated by the emotional power of the partial world that we, so many of us, live in. So we're working on that. That's what we're doing. We're working on seeing the world whole with eyes that can really see. When times are tough, he kept going, it's very easy to forget about that. And when we don't forget, what's really right up in front all the time is love and creativity, hopefulness, goodness. We understand that hope is literally built into the nature of reality, no matter what is going on. And that's what's happening as we study this sutra. We're working on it. We're working on seeing. What are we seeing? How are we seeing? I was watching a film the other night with friends. One of them said how seeing this film over and over again several times brought out something much subtler about it, brought out a much deeper beauty for her. And something about that began to open up in me that sense of slowing down. I rush around too much. Maybe some of you do too. And just slowing down and then repeating, chanting this sutra. Actually going to Thursday morning with Roberta was also really lovely. It has something to do, I think, with settling down the parasympathetic nervous system for me. So I'm encouraging all of us to see, to sit down and see, to let ourselves be in a pose of receptivity. And so I wanted to ask if now Jeff would talk. He selected something that I think is relevant here.
Thank you, John. What a beautiful talk you've given tonight. And thank you to the other readers. I chose number 40, Gopa, girl from Kapalavatsu. And what spoke to me about her was something Jean's mentioned a lot tonight, the idea of repetition and the power of repetition and of showing up over and over and bringing your bodhisattva self at each moment. So let me read. Gopa. Then Sudana left the Lumbini goddess and went to the city of Kapalavastu, cultivating that enlightening liberation of vision of miracles of birth, of enlightening beings in all objects over countless ages, entering into it, expanding it, practicing it, purifying it, mastering it, contemplating it, examining it, he made his way to the meeting hall of enlightening beings reflecting the cosmos. When he went there, a goddess of the enlightening beings meeting hall named Sorrowless, together with 10,000 house goddesses, appeared before Sudana and said to him, "Welcome is the great person with wisdom, knowledge, and courage, who roams the grounds of the vast palace of reality, intent on cultivating the inconceivable liberations of enlightening beings, in the presence of the city of truth, ceaselessly entering into the endless methods of enlightening beings, attaining manifestation of the ocean of virtues of those who realize thusness, aiming for the knowledge of how to act and speak so as to mature all people, acting and speaking according to knowledge of the behavior of all people, mind oriented towards spiritual practice, committed to increasing the flood of the ocean of joy in the feelings of all beings on the path of knowledge of the teaching of all those who arrive at thusness. As I see you with steady gaze on the pure realm of conduct of profound spiritual practice, before long you will attain perfection of the supreme ornaments of body, speech, and mind of the enlightened, and will act in the world with a body adorned with the marks and embellishments of greatness, and a mind adorned with the light of knowledge of the 10 powers. As I see your steadfast, energetic exertion, before long you will be furnished with all the requisites for manifesting your being in the presence of all Buddhas of past, present, and future, receiving their teachings, experiencing the delight of the tranquil palace of spirituality, with all the meditations, liberations, concentrations, and attainments of enlightening beings, you will see into the profound liberation of Buddhas. That is because you do not tire, do not regress, do not feel pain in going to spiritual benefactors, meeting them, associating with them, receiving instructions, and applying the ways to virtue. And you are not overcome by any interference or barrier of obstacle or by any demon or deity. Therefore, you will soon become a source of joy for all beings." Then Sudana said to the goddess Sorrowless, "May it be as you say, I would find supreme joy in extinguishing the burning of all beings' afflictions, in stopping the development of their evil deeds, in making them all happy, in getting them to act impeccably. Whenever sentient beings are involved in evil deeds and afflictions with scattered minds, fall into painful or pleasurable states, and experience various forms of physical or and mental distress, enlightening beings become most unhappy at that. Just as a doting parent would love its only child and would be most distressed at seeing the child be dismembered, in the same way, a practicing enlightening being is most unhappy to see people fallen into miserable states because of compulsion by afflictions and action. Whenever sentient beings live in felicity because of good thoughts, words, and deeds, and experience physical and mental pleasures in celestial and human realms, enlightening beings are delighted and become happy and joyful."
Thank you. We are becoming delighted and joyful in hearing you read. Thank you. Showing up. Yes, that's what we all need to be doing. Thank you, Gopa. Thank you, Jeff. We're almost finished here. What are we showing up for? What are we seeing? How are we seeing? Are we making real contact, connection? Or are we resisting? Only glancing or just glimpsing of what's going on in our life, in the world. I admit I've had a very hard time looking directly at certain images in the news, looking peripherally, sideways, sort of. I did that for 4 years earlier time, trying to bypass or dismiss certain faces and voices, trying to brush them aside. And yet, because I'm telling you about it right now, it's quite obvious they were not dismissed. And they continue to arise when I think of how I tried to deny that they exist. And yet, I believe we are all doing our best, communing together and developing eyes that really do see. developing hearts that really do expand, to feel the world whole, the world as it is otherwise. So, as I did the land acknowledgement, I also realized, talking about Mother Earth, that Heidi has chosen Mother Maya, Queen Maya, to read. And I thought to myself, yes, that's seeing the world whole, the world as it is, our whole Mother Earth, the one we care for and revere, the one we want for our children and their children and their children's children. So Heidi, would you please read from our last benefactor tonight, Queen Maya?
Yes, thank you, John, and all my wonderful Sangha members. I just feel so lucky that I feel like I know all of you. And Nick, what I'm going to do is kind of walk through the pages for Maya and stop here and there and read something. Would that work for you?
Yes, that works, and I have it pulled up starting on page 1429.
29, yeah, Maya. And I'd like to say a few words first.
Yes.
I have not thought of Maya before as a bodhisattva or really somebody to be thinking about. I was kind of disappointed when we got to Avalokiteshvara she didn't seem more familiar to me. But then I began to think, you know, we have a Maya in our Sangha, and that Maya has a mother named Maya who recently passed away, and that's very special to me. And Maya and birth seems passed over. Maya's mother has passed over. She died. Let me talk about Maya, when she gave birth to the Buddha, died after 7 days. Now, I hear about Mahapajapati a lot, but not Maya. However, something recently that I've experienced in my life has put a whole new perspective on Maya, and probably you've heard me talk about it if you're an early morning appear on Everyday Zen. I have adopted grandmother who gave birth and was in the hospital for 2 months right afterwards, and I just found out she was in a psychiatric hospital with postpartum distress. I just saw her last Sunday at the baptism of her baby. She didn't even hold her baby. Well, I had a serious talk with Maya, Lady Maya, over that, and she gave me great comfort when I thought that Maya's down to earth. That's why I like this particular one. She's down to earth, and that's showing us that we have all sorts of experiences in our life. And she gave a wonderful gift. Now I'm starting on 1429. Gopa told Sudana that the gift Maya would give him, and this is amazing, enlightenment by producing knowledge from compassion. So Sudana, on page 1431, meets a city goddess. I'm just going to talk you through this right now, named Jewel Eyes. And Jewel Eyes guards the city of mind. Now, this is striking bells to me. We just studied faith in mind, you know, the Xin Xin Ming. And here we have a goddess telling us to guard the city of our mind. Well, this sounds pretty contemporary to what we've been talking about and reading about. And then on page 1434, And well, it's 1435. He made another goddess who's spiritual lotus. And from spiritual lotus, Sudhana gets the eye called dispassionate light. But my favorite one is 1436. Another supernatural being named Fine Eye, doorkeeper of the Hall of Assembly of Enlightening Beings. And now, Philip would like this because he tells us 10 things. 10 things how to approach spiritual friends. Well, that's our Sangha. And, you know, to me, you're all spiritual friends, or we all are spiritual friends. And here it is in this sutra as a preface to meeting Lady Maya, that Sudhana is experiencing these aspects of our practice that relate very closely to me and my life and my practice. Then on page 1437, Sudhana asked this goddess, another one, spiritual lotus is this one, what should I meditate on to see spiritual friends? And Sudhana gets some information of what to do. Now it's on page 1438 that Sudhana actually sees Maya on a throne. And I'm skipping through this throne business because it's like a lot of the other parts of the sutra explaining the great beauty and so on. But I'm interested in 1444. Let me get it on mine. I'm reading from my phone. And just a minute, 2873. You sure? Okay, I got it. Yeah. Noble one, he said, Noble One Manjushri inspired me to seek supreme perfect enlightenment and directed me to attend spiritual benefactors. So I've been approaching spiritual friends, benefactors, and in the course of doing so, I have come to you. Now please tell me, Noble One, how an enlightening being may achieve omniscience while carrying out the practice of enlightening beings. She said, I have attained an enlightening liberation, magical manifestation of knowledge of great vows. Imbued with this liberation, I am the mother of all the enlightening beings in their final existence in all the worlds, in this world ocean, whereby, let's see, by Rokana Buddha's miraculous manifestation of birth as an enlightening being and the final existence takes place. All these enlightening beings grow in my belly and come forth from my right side. So here too, in this great city of the capital of Vastu, as wife of the king Suddhodana, I became the mother of the enlightening being Siddhartha by the great inconceivable miracle of the birth of the enlightening being. At that time, I was in the house of King Sudhana, and when the time of the enlightening being's descent from the heaven of contentment had arrived, from every pore the enlightening being emanated as many rays of lights as atoms in the untold Buddha lands, arrayed with the qualities of the birth of all enlightening beings, known as the light originating from the qualities of birth of all Buddhas. Those rays of light illumined the whole world, then descended on my body and entered into every pore of my body, beginning with my head. As soon as those light rays of the enlightening being, with various names, emanating magical projections of the various miracles attending the birth of an enlightening being had entered me, they caused the spheres of light at the front of the enlightening being's light rays to be manifest in my body, and the spiritual manifestation of miracles attending the birth of all enlightening beings were visible. And as soon as those light rays of the enlightening being had entered my body, I saw all the enlightening beings whose birth miracles were shown in the spheres at the front of the enlightening being's light rays as they sat on the Buddha's lion throne at the site of enlightenment, surrounded by congregations of enlightening beings honored by the leaders of the worlds, turning the wheel of the teaching. No, excuse me, it's jumping.
Heidi, I'm going to ask you if you can wrap it up because
I can. Yes, I will. And I will wrap it up. I'll wrap it up right now and say, I encourage you, those who feel close to Maya, to read the whole thing. It's well worth it. Okay, thank you very much, John.
Thank you very much. You just turned the wheel of Dharma.
I think I tried.
Fine place to end, yes. And I'll just say thank you also. Let's go into very quick breakout groups of two, please, Nick, for 6 minutes. Two people. What are you seeing? What are you hearing? That can be about the Sangha, the Sutra, the world. Please, 6 minutes. Can you do it?